The White Sox were supposed to be done early, and yet they just kept going and going and going, and to no avail. So another rough day for the Sox, but what are you going to do? We knew this was that's what the season was going to be. We have a huge show, and I can't believe it. We've got a lot of things booked. We are going to... We thought we were starting... Had the White Sox done what they were supposed to, we were the show was supposed to start a little earlier, so... I just got off the phone with the former Taoiseach, which is loosely translated to be Prime Minister of Ireland, Enda Kenny. He is coming into town for a big event on Wednesday and Thursday, so I just hung up the phone, Cody. Would that be accurate? Yes, Cody is making furious notes because things are changing by the minute. Live radio, very exciting, always on the fly. So we're going to you'll hear my conversation with him. We are also going to talk to a man who we visited with 2 years ago at the outset of a journey. Now he is 2 years into this journey. He is more than 80% done. We'll tell you what Micah Meyer has been up to. We're going to talk about a big guy. If you need to give some blood, or not if you need to, but if you're willing to, we'll talk about that. And then tomorrow evening at O'Hare, Uber and Lyft drivers are going to have a demonstration. We are going to talk to two of the founders of the Chicago Rideshare Advocates at 6 o'clock. So a lot to get to, Cody. I don't understand how we're going to do it. We also want to squeeze you in at 312-981-7200. When you do call that number, you'll be talking to Cody. Oh my gosh, we're actually working radio. Goff, he's the executive producer from Rockford, Illinois. If you are nice to him, you get to me on social media. We're Brian Noonan Show on Facebook and Twitter. And the phone number is the text number. Did I cover everything? Are we good?
Yeah, we're all good. Right. I think we're good. I think we're about there.
Yes, we are going to talk to Ryan Burrow in just a couple of minutes. He is in North Carolina. As you know, Florence made landfall. It was downgraded, but now we are getting to the point where the flooding is the major concern, and authorities in North Carolina are saying the worst is yet to come. So Ryan has been down there through it all. We will talk to Ryan in just a couple minutes. A lot going on, man. The city is abuzz with things. We got... All of a sudden, the former mayor, Bill Daley, the former mayor's brother, Bill Daley, is saying he's going to run for mayor now, throwing more. I think I'm the only person not running for mayor, which is sad, especially since earlier you asked me if I ever had any interest about running for office, Cody. I don't know what brought that on.
You haven't thrown your name in yet?
I haven't. I kind of put some feelers out last week when I was in for Dean. I was talking to the one and only Rick Pearson. And... right after the Sunday spin, and I asked him about that. I ran into trouble, one, because I don't technically live in the city. Two, I don't have a platform. Three, I have no desire to be mayor.
Yeah.
And four, I really am not qualified, I don't think, to be mayor. But that hasn't stopped people from seeking public office before.
I'm running.
You're running for mayor?
Yeah.
Why didn't you mention it? But now that you've said that, we have to give equal time to everybody else who's running for mayor. Oh, did Cody announce his candidacy on the show? Well, now all 87 candidates get to come in.
Oh,
and
yes.
And we'll give them as long as I just gave you to talk. They'll say, hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm running for mayor. Thank you. Good night.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's equal time.
Wow.
Do we even have equal time anymore? I don't think we do.
Yeah, we do.
We do? We have to give equal time?
Oh, we got memos and everything.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Press has to give a certain amount of time to each, but it doesn't. I don't think it started yet.
Okay, probably not.
I think it starts in a couple weeks.
All right. Well, listen. If any mayoral candidates want to come on, we'll talk to you.
Don't say that.
No, I want.
Then I got to do paperwork.
I want the fringe candidates.
Oh yeah.
I want I want people who not fringe like alt-right candidates, but just somebody with the wildest platform. Like, you know what? Every day, every citizen of Chicago will get a latte.
Mm.
That's pretty good. That's a pretty good platform right there.
Yeah.
So we do that. Those kind of candidates.
I'm set.
All dogs must wear diapers. I want a mayor who's going to outlaw dogs. I want a mayor who's going to outlaw dogs wearing clothes. I think animals should be animals.
Oh, no. Don't open this bucket of worms.
Well, it's
you know, for somebody who's not running for office, you're getting pretty controversial.
I'm very political. I'm out there on the fringes, Cody. I'm not afraid to speak my mind. That's what makes me a man of the people.
You know, we've got a guest in like 5 minutes. You can't just dump these hot takes out there like
listen,
dogs in clothing, lattes.
We only have so much time.
So you've got to hot take everything in the first 3 minutes.
Right. All the hot takes. I learned from Carmen and all the sports guys. You lead with the hot takes.
Oh.
That's what you do. You bring. I had a basket of hot takes. You saw me. I had two oven mitts, and I was carrying the basket of hot takes into the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just I like to pour them out, and they just like lava. Then they flow throughout the show.
Keep them coming. You got a call for the Vikings kicker to get fired.
Why? What did he do?
Didn't win the game today, apparently.
Oh, I don't. Listen, I watch the Bears, Cody. I'm not like you with, oh, you're so happy last week with the Packers.
I was kind of, but I still haven't watched an NFL game in like 7 years, so.
How'd you find out? Just somebody?
Well, I found out because it was hilarious.
Because on Twitter everybody was crying?
Yes, well, because I go, I read wrestling columns on uproxx.com, and then they mentioned.
Ding, ding, ding.
They mentioned the Bears somehow managed to just, like, epically fail in the, like, they blew like a 20-something to 3 lead in the fourth quarter. Yeah, I'm like, how is that
to,
even.
It was 20 to nothing at one point, and then
yeah,
things
I'm like,
got really
how
bad.
Is that even numerically possible? So I watched the highlights just to kind of catch up, and it was, I got a good little chuckle out of it.
The one thing I missed after that abysmal performance in the second half was listening to Hampo B and Kaz. I'm sure there was two or three aneurysms. There was a lot of spittle. These guys had to be angry.
Do you think they were screaming?
I'm going to say there probably weren't three words that weren't being screamed. After something like that. Because if you're like me, I pay attention, but I'm not, overly invested. I was watching the game, and I was so excited at the beginning, I actually started, like, meathead tweeting of, when people would think, the worst cliched meathead topics. Like, I'm selling my wife's engagement ring to buy all the jerseys of the entire defense. Now, those kind of things, like mm-hmm. what a meathead would say. And then it all just fell apart. That's when I turned on something else. I was like, I can't deal with this. Are we all right? So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we will talk to Ryan Burrow, who is in North Carolina. He'll give us an update on Florence. We've got a lot to get to and not much time to do it. So sit back, buckle up. It's time to go, WGN. Brian Noonan, 720 WGN. We've all been following the news of Hurricane Florence becoming Tropical Storm Florence, now Tropical Depression Florence. It is really, really wreaking havoc throughout the southeast. And according to officials, the worst is yet to come. Ryan Burrow has been down in North Carolina covering things for ABC News. And I am happy to welcome him back to the show. Ryan, thanks for taking some time. It's had to be a rough few days down there.
It really has, because the rain started, I want to say Thursday, and it just has not stopped. It just keeps coming. We actually here in Fayetteville have a little bit of a break right now, which is very welcome news, because this is an area that's seen a lot of inland flooding. And there are two rivers here, the Little River and the Cape Fear River. You may know that word, Cape Fear. There was a movie in 1991 called Cape Fear.
Every time you report on Cape Fear, I just picture Robert De Niro hanging under a car trying to evacuate, which is wrong, but
I was on a bridge above Cape Fear today, and it is very impressive to see how strong that current is right now. It is literally pulling trees down the stream, and it's starting to create little dams too under these bridges, because all the trees and debris are getting caught under there. And there are a lot of people that live within a mile of Cape Fear River, and as a result, they've been told that they've got to evacuate. And the mandatory evacuation order went into effect an hour and 19 minutes ago. So, hopefully, people heeded the warning, because the concern is, the thing is, they saw flooding similar to this with Hurricane Matthew back in 2016, but this is actually supposed to crest 4 feet higher than Matthew, so ooh, it's going to be even worse than what they saw then.
And the part of Fayetteville is in the evacuation zone. I'm guessing you're not in that zone, in the mandatory evacuation zone, but are you seeing people listening to the officials this time? Because they're not mincing any words down there. They said, listen, you have to go, because one of the officials said, if you're not going to evacuate, contact your next of kin, because it's going to be bad.
Yeah, the mayor said that, Mitch Colvin, and they don't want to have to go and rescue people. You put more people in harm's way by doing that, and they don't want to do that. So they're telling people, look, don't mess around with it. Get out of here. We've got shelters if you wanted. You can, of course, stay at hotels, although there aren't many hotel vacancies right now between all the evacuees and all of the power workers and all of the reporters that are here. You know, a lot of these hotels are completely full right now. It's interesting because a lot of the people who are in these hotels in Fayetteville are actually from Wilmington, and they're from the coast. They thought that they would be fine coming here, not realizing that, you know, the flooding is probably going to be just as bad, if not worse here than it was there. So a lot of them are actually planning to make the trek back in the dangerous road conditions to get back home to find out, you know, what the damage is. And unfortunately, we just had our 16th death in the Carolinas, another traffic incident. And, you know, that's kind of led the way of late, people either driving into flooded areas or getting into car crashes. And, you know, the roads are very, very dangerous right now. In fact, in Fayetteville, a lot of the street lights are out. So either people aren't recognizing them and just driving right through them. Of course, nobody's making four-way stops. There are tree limbs everywhere. There's water rushing. So it's just very, very treacherous out there.
And something I hadn't thought of, they're also telling people, listen, if you are going to go out, which they, again, are not recommending, don't trust your GPS because the GPS systems aren't keeping up with the conditions. So the roads are flooding. And if you're not paying attention, you're just, well, I'm going where my GPS tells me to go. You could be in some serious trouble.
Yeah, and, you know, just to show you how serious this is, too, I-95 pretty much connects, New York down to Miami, right? You take I-95, it is shut down where I'm at right now. And they're actually rerouting people, telling people in Virginia to go around the state.
Oh, geez.
Go from Virginia to Tennessee down and then cut back in with South Carolina and into Georgia because it's just not worth it to try to get through the flooded roadways. I-95 is flooded. I-40 is flooded. So they just don't want people messing around.
And this is something that if you haven't been through a flood like this, which I have not, thank goodness, we always ask the question when people don't evacuate. And, you know, there's all sorts of reasons, whether it's economic or they just, you know, they want to stay and protect their property. What's the pulse of the locals that you're talking to? Are they determined some to stay? Are they really heeding? Because it seems every time we have one of these natural disasters, government officials make it, their language gets more and more plain that, listen, you have got to go. There's no two ways about it. And we still see people staying. What's the pulse of the people down there?
You know, people are taking this seriously, and I think the fact that they saw what happened during Matthew is helping. And the fact that this could be worse, I mean, that was massive widespread flooding, and it took a lot of people by surprise. So now 2 years later, here we go again. Let's not get caught the same way we did 2 years ago. That being said, people are very protective of their property. They don't like the idea of being away, either not knowing what's going on, not being in control of what's going on. You know, and so I talked with a couple from the coast who wanted to go back today. I said, even with all of the road issues, they said, yeah. They said, we know we don't have power, but we want to get back. We want to, you know, we've got candles at home. We've got flashlights. We can handle that, but we're not interested in staying in a hotel for 2-3 more days not knowing. And that seems to be what a lot of people who evacuated are feeling. They're just anxious to get back. You know, we all think, oh, that's fun. We'll go to a hotel for, you know, 3-4 days, five days, and it'll be like a vacation. No, I mean, you're constantly worried. You're constantly talking with family and relatives and people who stayed and people who didn't stay and getting updates. And, you know, it's a working vacation, let's put it that way. Now, for the people who stay, economics is a big part of it. You know, they can't afford to stay in a hotel. And it's not just staying in a hotel. You've got to get food somehow. You've got to go out to restaurants, if there are restaurants. One of the problems we've had here is the restaurants have been without power. The retails have been without power. Grocery stores without power. The hotels have been without power. It's 48 hours without power in my hotel, which makes for interesting living quarters, by the way. If you've ever been in a hotel with no power, all of a sudden people, things get very crowded and humanity becomes very evident.
And it's warm and smelly.
It's warm and smelly, and there, you know, people are able to bring dogs in because they're evacuated, and it's just, it makes for very interesting conditions when everyone's kind of cranky to begin with.
Sure.
So,
it's a glamorous life of a reporter, Ryan, is what you're telling us. This is what the media, the palatial estates that the media gets put up in.
Sure, sure. Yeah, you know, it's I got a trunk full of what do I got? I got granola bars and Gatorade and trail mix. I've pretty much gotten through the beef jerky.
Okay.
And I got 5 gallons of gas in the back just in case. Now, thankfully, wow. Here there are some gas stations that are open. Not all of them, we don't see the big massive runs on gas like we do have at the coast. So I haven't had to use it. I'll probably use it before I return the car. But you know, it's.
There's reports coming out about price gouging. Have you been hearing complaints about that or seen that yourself?
I have not. I mean, the gas prices here are $2.56 a gallon. I don't think that's too bad.
Okay, yeah, that's
based on the Chicago prices, everything seems fine. I mean, for the most part, the people, the gas stations that are open had people that could man them. I think for the people, the gas stations that shut down just didn't have people to man them. The supply isn't that big of an issue. And in fact, if you're worried about long-term gas prices as a result of Florence, it doesn't sound like it's that big of a deal. I talked to Patrick DeHaan with GasBuddy.com. He said there are literally no refineries that were in this path at all. There's a refinery in Savannah, Georgia, but that does like 28,000 barrels a day, which is nothing. So, you know, it doesn't sound, maybe it was 2,800. I can't remember, but he said it really won't impact gas prices nationwide.
And now they're forecasting that by the end of this storm, Florence will have dropped about 40 inches of rain over the southeastern North Carolina. What's your forecast as you're watching the weather now? You said you're in a short break now where the rain has stopped. Is the rain, are they saying the rain will be done by today or tomorrow, and then we just wait for the, you know, and watch for the flooding?
Exactly. Tomorrow, it looks like we've got a flash flood advisory in effect until 10 o'clock tonight. The rain should taper off by tomorrow, but yeah, the problem is all that rain that fell is going to rush through the Cape Fear River, and it needs to get to the ocean.
Yeah.
And so this river is expected to crest at 62 feet,
wow,
which is 4 feet above where it was during Hurricane Matthew. Not quite a record, but still enough to do significant flooding. And, of course, they're worried here that some of that flooding will go into downtown, could get into the sanitation areas, and, you know, cause some real chaos for people.
How long are they anticipating, or are they telling people that they have to be evacuated? You know, as you said, an hour and 20 minutes ago about the mandatory evacuation went into effect.
Yeah.
How long are they telling people, or are they not giving them a timeline at all?
They are not. And I talked to the Red Cross about the shelters, and they said, we're not putting a timeline on this. We're going to see how this goes. I mean, it's possible people are in there for days. It's possible people are in there for weeks. They've got to get power back up. I mean, why go back to a home where there's no power, you know, or that's, you know, still flooded? So they're not going to kick them out. I can tell you that schools are a good gauge as to how seriously things are being taken, and mm-hmm. schools are canceled for the first 2 days of the week so far. And I'm sure that that will be extended as they find out more and understand more about this storm, and especially the river's flooding.
And as I watched all the, you know, the Sunday morning shows, it seems like the response from FEMA and everybody else is on point. Everything's going as smoothly as can be expected or hoped for?
As far as we know. I mean, the biggest issue is the high water rescues right now. They've got these high water vehicles. They've got swift boats. They called in people from across the country. There's a California team here in Fayetteville. There's, I believe, seven Nebraska teams here as well. The U.S. Coast Guard's involved. National Guard is involved. And even the county's got a bunch, too. And they're just standing by. I talked with some of them. They hadn't made any rescues, thankfully.
Yeah.
But they're standing by. They're prepared if need be. And unfortunately, those rescues may be coming in the next couple of days if people fail to evacuate.
Well, hopefully people listen. And as we said, it's easy to sit back and judge. You know, what, they told them to leave. Why didn't they leave? There's a myriad of reasons why people aren't leaving. So it's, you know, you just hope for the best.
This is the way I put it. You know, if we knew that a snowstorm was going to wallop us at, you know, 21 inches of snow,
mm-hmm.
And that there was potential that your power would go out, would you leave?
Yeah.
And I bet a lot of us would say, no, I can handle
yes,
the snow. Snow's
exactly.
No big deal. These people can deal with rain. It's not that big of a deal. You know, it's one of those things like, do I really want to up my life and move out just because we're going to get a little
exactly.
bit of snow? And that's what a lot of people think. You know?
Well, then that's it. And then man, then you hear the numbers of the water, the inches, and how deep it's going to get, and you really you worry. But be careful. Did the hotel get power back?
Yeah, I did. Okay. This is my third hotel in this city so far because everyone's losing vacancy and getting vacancy, and so I've been kind of shuffling around, which is fine. I can't complain. I got a place to stay. I'm very, very happy about that. But
and you got granola bars. You're golden.
Granola bars and Gatorade. You got it.
Yeah, you're all set.
There are restaurants open here, so that's been helpful.
That's good. And so school's canceled for the next couple days. We're going to be bracing for the floods, or they'll be bracing for the floods, and you'll be down there as long as need be.
Mm-hmm. Until the flights start getting out, probably.
Yeah, I love the way he says. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. It's like, well, I'm here. Are they giving any indication when the airports might reopen?
Well, you know, it sounds like Raleigh-Durham is actually functioning. It may not be at 100% right now. That's probably the closest one to me. Charlotte's also taken quite a hit, by the way, with flooding as well as some wind damage. So we'll keep an eye on that because the system's kind of moving that direction right now.
All right. Well, Ryan, it is always good to talk to you. Be careful, and thanks for taking time today. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
All right. We'll talk to you later. That's Ryan Burrow covering Florence for ABC News and, of course, WGN Radio. So we thank him for that. Man, I would not want to be anywhere near... no thanks. All right, it's 4:30 on 720 WGN. That means it's time for the news. This report is sponsored by It's Just Lunch. Hi, Pam Jones. Kind of the impression, because of the early East Coast start time of the Sox game, that it was going to end at a, earlier than normal. It did not. And so at 3:30, we were scheduled to speak with the former Prime Minister, or Taoiseach, of Ireland, Enda Kenny. He is coming into town for a big benefit on Wednesday and Thursday. And so we talked to him at 3:30. We weren't on the air yet. Mark Carman was finishing things up with the White Sox. But, you know, you talk to a world leader. When world leaders come to town, who do they talk to, Cody? Talk to me. And you're thinking, why would he talk to you? Well, because I'm emceeing this event on Thursday, so it was... I was like, okay, it was very exciting. So, we don't usually do this. This is very unique, but this is a conversation that happened an hour ago when, we were supposed to be doing it live. Anyway, this is my, conversation with the former Taoiseach. Ryan Noonan on 720 WGN this Thursday night at the Drake Hotel. The Ireland Fund is presenting the Oneness Gala to benefit Scully O'Connell GAA Club in Dublin. Joining me now to explain what all of that means is the former Prime Minister of Ireland, or do you say Taoiseach, Enda Kenny. Mr. Kenny, thanks for taking some time to be here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much indeed. Good to be on your program. And, great to have this Oneness project in Chicago this week.
Yeah,
the pronunciation is correct.
Okay, that's what I wanted to check, if I had the correct pronunciation.
Yeah, if you take the first half of one of your former presidents, Theodore Roosevelt, take the T, and then shock, Taoiseach is the correct pronunciation. Shock. And in the Irish language, that really means a tribal leader or a chieftain.
Very nice.
It's not the direct translation for sort of first minister or prime minister, because it goes back much further than that. But all Irish people understand what the word Taoiseach means. So the next time you hear it, if you think of Theodore, the first portion of that, and then sometimes you get a shock in life. So Taoiseach.
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting you on Thursday at the event. For those who aren't familiar, what is a GAA club?
Well, the letters stand for the Gaelic Athletic Association. Ireland was a very impoverished country for so many years, and in 1884, a group of gentlemen came together and formed this association. The purpose of the association was to foster games of Ireland, that is, the game of hurling, and the game of football, the game of handball, and the game of rounders. And the social dimension of that was to draw communities together. So having evolved from that point to 2018, you have a situation right throughout the island of Ireland, north and south, where each county has its own GAA team. And these run from adults right down to boys and girls. But it's a voluntary organization, and the spirit and the passion and the leadership is vested in the communities. So at the All-Ireland Finals, when the best teams in the country compete for the national prize, which is a cup called after one of the great of Irish history, Sam Maguire, who was involved in the early part of the last century's revolutions. There are 80,000 people plus turn up, and they're all amateur players. They're not paid, and their level of fitness and skill has to be seen to be believed.
Wow.
So it's an organization that lends itself to sport, giving young people team discipline, character training, understanding of what courage and perseverance and commitment really is. So it gives them standards that can be applied throughout their lives. And that's why Scully Connell, which stands for O'Connell Schools, founded in 1828 by Daniel O'Connell, the parliamentarian, politician and emancipator of Ireland, founded this school along with the head of the Christian Brothers, Edmund Rice, at the time. And that was to lend an education to young boys and girls so that they could find an opportunity in life to give off their best.
And the O'Connell School had been going for years. It's a 180-year tradition. During the 90s, Dublin, the inner city of Dublin, started facing problems similar to what we have in Chicago and most major cities have. And the school kind of went through a downturn, but it has come back. What led to the renaissance of the O'Connell School?
You're right in the sense that Dublin, no more than any other major city, suffered from both recession, from unemployment, but also from the infiltration of drugs, criminal activities, and drug gangs, warfare on some of the streets. And that has continued to an extent. And obviously the north inner city of Dublin has been very much akin to many of the difficult and challenging areas of many of the American cities. And because of the connections that we have had with the United States and Chicago, one of the great cities of the world in particular, we felt that here was an opportunity for the community from the north inner city to empathize and engage with similar situations in Chicago. So the Scully Connell, the school has been in existence for 180 years. The GAA Club of Scully Connell, which is very closely associated with the schools, has been founded since 1950. And while they declined in terms of sporting achievements, they never shirked their responsibilities in giving an education to children from many countries, because in fact they now educate children from over 40 different nations.
Wow.
In the north inner city of Dublin. So because people from the area have been working in Chicago, Sheila Kelly in particular and many others, it was felt that they would put together a fundraiser in Chicago to buy the football pitch for future generations of boys and girls from 6 north inner city schools. And out of that has evolved a project that has the support of so many people and organizations, which will lead to a cultural exchange so that young people from Dublin can go to Chicago and young people from Chicago can come to Dublin. And we're working on that with the Obama Foundation, with Juan Segado, of the Chancellor of the City Colleges of Chicago. And there will be an occasion in the Cut in LaSalle on Wednesday, followed by the Oneness Gala in the Drake on Thursday. So it's an opportunity to express and give results, if you like, to what people want here, which is to show vulnerable and challenged young people that there are different opportunities out there. And the Gaelic Athletic Association, with its inspiration through sport, and now with connections with Chicago, can lead for a true understanding, or if you like, a true oneness about all of that.
Now, when people come to the gala, and if you're interested, you can go to IrelandFunds.org to get all the information and to purchase your tickets for the gala and for everything else that is coming up on Wednesday. Again, it's a Thursday night at the Drake Hotel. When people come there, Mr. Kelly, you're giving a keynote address, but there's going to be a lot more going on. Can you give us an overview of what we can expect?
First of all, on the Wednesday, there is the opportunity down at the Chicago Cut to see students from the colleges in Chicago putting forward their views and their projects on how business could be done between the United States, Chicago, and Ireland. And I myself will be one of the judges, along with the head of global brand for Google, in that competition, and that's on Wednesday down in 300 North LaSalle, which is owned indeed by a Dublin man, Matt Moore. And on Thursday, then, is the Gala Foundation, which has the support of many major companies in America and many major companies from Ireland that are working in the States. Obviously, Senator Billy Lawless there, who is appointed to the Irish Senate, has been a major feature in making connections in all of this. So obviously it's an opportunity for people to get together to understand what all this is about. That what does anybody want anyway except to give opportunity to the next generation? And because of my own interest in this, when I was privileged to be Taoiseach in Ireland, we took a very particular interest in sorting out and dealing with criminality in the north inner city, but in providing facilities and opportunities for sporting organizations and for educators and for parents to give their children the very best opportunity in a world that has changed so rapidly. So Thursday is an opportunity not just to raise money through the good facilities of the Ireland Funds and Kieran McLaughlin, who oversees all of this, that everything is completely and utterly above board, but also for people to make connections that will work into the future, both between Dublin and Chicago and between the United States and Ireland, to build on those historic and very powerful links that we've had for so many years.
It sounds like a simple message, and we hear it. We hear it here in Chicago, and you've mentioned that it, in Dublin's north inner city, that we can use sport to change lives. It sounds naive, but it really can happen. Would you agree?
Yes, I do agree, and obviously we have so many examples of this, particularly where, and it's not just the Gaelic Athletic Association, I have to say, there's other sporting organizations as well, be it boxing or soccer or basketball or whatever, where young people who have a talent or who can be encouraged to participate in team events or in sport and can see their way to giving vent to their ability and their creativity, you know, to break out of the rut that they are expected to be in just because they might be born in a particular district or because they might be challenged or those challenges exist for one reason or another. So while the state works very hard through different organizations to give the opportunities for everybody to do their best, voluntary sporting organizations, the interest of parents and the commitment of young people themselves, they can see that there is a different direction up ahead and a different road that they can take, that they can be who they want to be, and that they don't have to follow the traditional line, in some cases, of criminality and going down the road of a very difficult life up ahead. So sport has, in so many countries, has given millions of opportunities for people to be inspired, to follow a different track. And that in its own way is what Scully Connell and the GAA are doing here in engaging with and investing in Chicago. And I hope that over the next 10 years that you're going to see the evolution both ways, so that opportunities like arise through the C2C program in Chicago for young people who are challenged and who are vulnerable can come to Ireland, can see that travel broadens the mind, can see how other young people work and relate, their activities, their music, their culture, their sport, all of these things can inspire people to do something better and something different.
Well, and, speaking with you, and you know, we realize people are the same everywhere. The cities are the same. Kids are the same everywhere. Whether you're in Dublin, whether you're in Chicago, doesn't matter. We need something for these kids to do to try to structure their lives a little bit to get them, keep them on the right track or get them back on the right track.
And that's absolutely right. And obviously, you know the difficulties that arise here where grandparents or parents might never have had a job, might have had all the difficulties that are associated with that. And there are some instances of this, obviously, in every city in the world. So it's a case of providing the infrastructure and the facilities where people can enjoy themselves and can get away from that, from that particular position every day, but can be inspired through teamwork, association with other team players, to follow their own dreams, give the best that they can do to their athleticism, and through that learn what commitment is, what belief is, what training is, and what success can actually bring. So here's an example of building on very long-term connections between Ireland and America, between Dublin and Ireland and Chicago, and in a modern sense, using all of these things to give the young people an understanding that they can actually do so much better and they can follow their own particular dream. And sport has a massive impact on that. And that's why the opportunity for people to invest in the Scully Connell football pitch will guarantee for the next generations of young boys and girls who attend Scully Connell the opportunity to play on their field of dreams, if you want to put it that way.
Speaking with former Taoiseach of Ireland, Enda Kenny, the Oneness Gala is Thursday, September 20th at the Drake Hotel. If you go to IrelandFunds.org, you can get all the information. There is an event on Wednesday at Chicago Cut as well. You mentioned the Ireland Funds before, Mr. Kenny. Can you give people a brief overview on what the Ireland Funds is and how they got involved with the GAA?
The Ireland Funds were set up by Tony O'Reilly and the late Dan Rooney, who owned the Pittsburgh Steelers, over 50 years ago. And they were set up as a global organization to provide funding for a country that was impoverished and to provide opportunities to build, you know, social cohesion and opportunity for so many people. And the Ireland Funds have raised hundreds of millions over those years all over the world. But because the Ireland Funds has the status and the reputation that it has, it acts as a guarantor so that where charities are involved and where people give donations for that, the Ireland Funds are the conduit to see that everything is absolutely above board and clear, and we're very happy to be associated with the Ireland Funds in this case and in so many others. They do marvellous work, and we're always grateful to those people who donate in a philanthropic way for what are very just and deserving causes. Here's another one. So I hope to see as many good friends as we can have on Wednesday and on Thursday. I look forward to going back to, the city of big shoulders again on this week.
Yes, we look forward to having you. And if people aren't able to attend but they still want to donate, you can go to IrelandFunds.org and you can donate as well. Before I let you go, Mr. Kenny, we've been talking about sport in Ireland. And my family, my cousins, make hurling sticks. The people over here, we don't know what hurling is. We see Irishmen running around with helmets and a stick, and they're trying to balance a ball. Can you give a brief overview of, for the uneducated, what's hurling?
Hurling is one of the oldest games in the world, and it's the fastest field game in the world. It's a team of 15 players, goalposts over the bars of point, under the bars of goal, equivalent of 3 points. They play with a hurley, which the Irish word for it is a camón made of ash. And carved in a particular way. The ball was originally a ball stuffed with leather or rags and bound with leather. It's called a slither, S-L-I-O-T-H-A-R. But the players today don't just play a game. It's a sublime art of people who are exceptionally talented and gifted. If you watch it in its intensity, in slow motion, it really is it's an art form. These are amateur players. 82,000 turn up to see the national finals every year. And because of injuries in the past, helmets are now worn by all players. So it's a game of great pace, of great skill, of great precision, and great rivalry, and yet great friendship. So memories are built through this. It's one of the oldest games in the world. They say in Irish legend that Cú Chulainn, the great warrior champion, used to play hurling. So in 1884, when the Gaelic Athletic Association was founded, hurling was a central part of it. It's played exceptionally well in quite a number of counties in Ireland, weak in others, but great efforts have been made to stimulate it throughout the island.
And what was your sport? Were you hurling? Was it football? What was your expertise?
I live in the west of Ireland, in County Mayo. And football, Gaelic football was our game.
Okay.
Obviously, hurling wasn't as strong then as it is now. But it's you either play one or the other in my time. And as a matter of interest, as people in Chicago will well know, we as a county have been waiting for over 6 decades to win the national championship.
So what's the problem? What's going on? Why is it taking so long for Mayo to step up?
Well, it means you've got to get a team that's going to win.
There you go. Well, listen, we're talking about sports, and the Oneness Gala to benefit the Scully O'Connell GAA Club is on Thursday to try to build a pitch for generations of Dublin's inner city boys and girls to continue their athletic endeavors. It's a wonderful, wonderful cause for a great organization. If you can be there, come. It's Thursday at the Drake Hotel. If not, you can still go to IrelandFunds.org and make a donation. Nick Kenny will be making the keynote speech. There is going to be great entertainment there as well. A virtuoso violinist from Ireland is going to be doing some entertainment. There's live auction items. It's going to be a wonderful night for a great cause. And since I've learned how to say Taoiseach, I feel I'm halfway there. I'm not going to embarrass myself too much.
You'll have your passport to Ireland before too long. That pronunciation is 100% correct.
Well, thank you very much. I'm doing my family proud.
Thank you for the opportunity to say these few words to your listeners.
You're very welcome. I will see you Thursday night. Thanks very much.
God bless.
Take care. That is the former Taoiseach of Ireland, Enda Kenny. He will be the keynote speaker at the Oneness Gala, which is happening. Or do you say gala? I say gala because I'm goofy. Thursday night, September 20th, the Drake Hotel. It is 140 East Walton Place. You know where that is. A champagne reception. There's dinner. It's going to be a wonderful night to benefit Scully Collin, GAA Clubs, and the Ireland Fund. So I'm looking forward to it. Big doings, Cody. I'm gonna be all over that thing. MCing the heck out of it. All right, let's do this. Then there's more. It's WGN. We'll be here next week, and next week we will have announcements about this program.
Well, you'll be here next week.
Yes, you will not be here.
No, I'll be in New York City for a wedding.
Which is weird because Molly is leaving New York City to come here next weekend. So do they have one of those? Is it like a bar? One person leaves, another person can go in?
Is she avoiding me?
I think so.
She did one podcast with us back in December.
Right.
I must have left a really bad taste in her mouth.
She was like, I don't know what part of New York Cody's going to, but I'm leaving. I'm taking off. This city of 8 million people is not big enough for the both of us.
Wait, actually, you know what? I keep lying. I'm actually going to Philadelphia.
That's completely different than New York.
Here's the thing. My brother...
100% different.
My brother... Well, my current brother. My brother-in-law lives in New York, but he's getting married in Philadelphia, and I've been telling people for like a month we're going to New York, but we're really going to Philadelphia, which you'd think I would know they're two different cities.
And it's not like you're going to a... Philadelphia is not a suburb of New York City.
No.
It's not like you're going to one of the five boroughs. You're going to a different state.
Yeah.
Different city. The birthplace of American democracy.
My dad's whole family lives in Philadelphia. Yeah. That's where he's from.
Cheese steaks are there. The King of Prussia Mall.
Oh, I'm going to eat so many cheese steaks.
There's a lot of things. Philly has its own identity. For you to keep giving it short shrift
because you want to say
you're going to New York.
I think, Joel, I think New York. So I just clump the East Coast. Because, you know, on a map, all the little states are too tiny to label. So they've just got a bunch of lines that dump out into the Atlantic.
Let me tell you, the Pennsylvania... portion of the map, quite sizable. Pennsylvania is a huge state.
That's fair.
Philadelphia, also in Pennsylvania, just in case suddenly I'm doing third grade geography with Cody.
Thank you.
You know a man who doesn't need your bad map skills because he has been traveling this great nation for the last 2 years is Micah Meyer. We talked in August of 2016, we talked to Micah, and he had just started his journey. He is on a mission to visit all 417 national parks and report back and share his findings with the world. And so back in August, he was about 7% done. Well, now fast forward to, what is it, 2018? Is that where? Yes, August 2018, but it's September 2018. And now Micah is almost 86% done, and he joins us now on WGN. Micah, first of all, congratulations. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. After 60,000 miles and seeing you, I'm very happy to be alive and able to join the show again.
Well, it's exciting. So for people who may not have been listening 2 years ago, and I don't know why they wouldn't have been, but you know, we've been here for a while. Explain how your mission came about, and why the national parks?
Yeah, well, my dad passed away from cancer when I was 19 years old and was a big road trip fan. So every year since his funeral, really, I've taken one road trip around the time of his death to honor him and honor the time that he didn't get. And along the years, I visited a few national parks or sites, and they were some of the most amazing places I'd ever been. And also realized that all my peers thought they were guaranteed to live to 80. So I wanted to do something crazy when I turned 30 to sort of shake my generation and let them know that you know, just as my dad died at age 58, they might not make it to retirement to pursue their dreams. So they really need to chase them now while they're alive to do so.
And besides spreading that message, which I think is invaluable, it doesn't matter how old you are, you have to realize tomorrow's not guaranteed. So if there's something you want to do, you've got to go out and do it. You're also helping spread the LGBT word and hoping to be a new kind of role model for that community as well.
Totally. When I started this journey, I was really hesitant to talk about being an openly gay man who loved the outdoors because at the time, the outdoors industry had never featured an openly gay man in any of their ads and hadn't even had a Pride Month ad during a millennium where even Mormon-owned Marriott had Pride Month ad campaigns. And so I was really scared to talk about that, but then I got a message from a teenager who said, I'm 15 years old, I go to a private Baptist school in Texas, and I'm not out of the closet to anyone. But I read about you, and I read about your journey, and now I know that when I grow up, not only can I be ordinary, but I can also be extraordinary. And so really, since then, I've made it much more of a mission in my journey to really share this awareness that there are tons of LGBT people who are very involved in the outdoors industry, and we just haven't gotten the attention that we should.
And part of what you do is you take the rainbow flag and you're photographed at all the national parks with it. And the message, while similar, there are different levels of the message for that community, right?
It is completely. I mean, I get messages every day from people around the world who say, you know, I'm a gay man and I love the outdoors too, and I've never seen anyone like me until you. And along the way, I've also started talking about being a pastor's son and being a practicing Christian. And so now I get messages every day from people who say I'm an LGBT Christian and my church told me that I couldn't exist. And now you're looking proof that I can. So it's been really amazing to see that the more I sort of share this journey openly and honestly, the more it's connecting with people from around the world and helping encourage and inspire their lives.
Now, this whole journey started, as you said, as a tribute to your dad who passed away. Was there an aha moment somewhere along where you decided, you know what, now it's taken on more than that, and I'm going to open up all these different avenues and let people know the real me?
Definitely.
Were you sitting on a, you know, a cliff in one of the national parks and it just hit you, or how did you make the decision?
It was sort of a slow burn, you know. It was all these people who were messaging me and saying, like, I've never seen anyone like me until you. And so just realizing I had this amazing platform through this journey and the media attention it was getting that I really could be kind of the voice for the voiceless. And so whether it's been with my Rainbow Flag photo series or talking to outdoor brands, trying to encourage them to be more inclusive, or visiting churches now along my journey and sharing a message of hope for people who never heard one, it's been so incredible to use that inspiration that others gave me through sharing their stories to now share my story in a way that makes them feel empowered.
And the journey has been going on, as you said, for a couple of years. It's very exciting. There's been a lot of talk with the new administration about funding for national parks, and mm-hmm. it's something that, unless you've been to a national park, you can't understand the beauty and the majesty of these places. As you've been going around and not only seeing the parks, but I'm guessing talking to the people who work at the national parks, is there a sense of nervousness? What are you finding as you go from park to park?
Definitely. I mean, I think everyone is on edge because they honestly have no idea what could happen tomorrow. There's sort of no track record to go on, and so they're all just wondering, can we plan for the future? Can we figure out what our park needs? Because it feels like any day we could either get what we need or our park could be shrunk in half.
Yeah.
So just sort of that uncertainty, everyone is definitely on edge and not knowing what the future holds.
Well, as we look at your map, now I didn't realize that 417 national parks in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You're 87% done, so where do you still have to go?
Yeah, so fortunately, I made it through Alaska this summer. There were 23 sites up there, and only 6 of them you can drive to.
Oh, wow.
So the other 17, I was in bush planes and backcountry tours and boats and carrying bear spray everywhere. And made the drive across Canada, just dropped into the Dakotas, and am making my way to the East Coast. I have 59 sites in between Ohio, North Carolina, actually the beaches that are getting slammed right now, and up to Pennsylvania, where Cody's headed.
He thinks he doesn't know if he's going to Pennsylvania. He may just be going to Iowa. He doesn't. He really doesn't know.
But then I have one park in Guam that I have to fly over to the other end of the world for, okay. And then I will end this journey on April 29th at the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Completed 3-year journey, every state and territory, 417 parks, and probably collapse afterwards.
Yeah, and that is the 11th anniversary of your dad's passing away. It's going to be an unbelievable tribute when it's over. And has there been a point where you're where you thought, oh, this is too much? I can't possibly finish this.
Probably about once a week. For the first year of this journey, I was dating someone, and he came along with me, and living in a van 24/7 together on the road was just too tough, and so we broke up. And so really, for the past year and a half, I've been completely alone, and it's been one of the most lonely experiences of my life. And so really struggling to sort of keep the motivation to keep going, because you can stare at amazing, beautiful places, but if there's nobody there next to you at sunset, it doesn't really mean a lot.
Yeah, that makes that would be rough.
Yeah, so it's been a slog to keep going, but really it's been hearing from all these people and the way that this journey is touching them that makes me realize I absolutely cannot quit. Yeah. And there's so many people counting on me to do this that's what keeps me going.
You are so close, and people can go to MicahMeyer.com to follow the journey, to donate, to help the cause, because it's, you know, I can't imagine what it costs to keep rolling. Now, did you buy one of the national park passes? Is that, do they still have those where you get into all the national parks if you buy this one thing?
They do, yeah. So for $80 a year, you can get into all 122 of the sites that charge a fee to enter. The rest of them are actually free. But yeah, you know, fundraising, I about ran out of money about 6 months after I last talked to you. And it was actually only through starting to speak at churches and share my story at churches that I started getting enough funding to stay on the road. And so when I come to Chicago later this month on September 30th, I'm actually speaking at two churches in Evanston at Trinity Lutheran at 8:30 a.m. on the 30th for their Sunday service, and then at Grace Lutheran on September 30th at 7 p.m. I'm doing a whole cabaret show. It's kind of like a Dolly Parton style concert where I tell jokes, I share clips and photos from the road, and sing songs that have been inspired by the people I've met, and it's like one big fun humorous night, and it's a big fundraiser to make sure I can finish these parks.
There you go. And we were going to get to that. It's because you're going to be in Madison doing the show on September 26th at Trinity Lutheran Church in Madison. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to be in Milwaukee on September 27th at Mount Carmel Lutheran Church. Then, as you said, Evanston, you'll be at the Grace Lutheran Church that Sunday, September 30th, 7 p.m. So in Valpo, too. You're going to be in Valpo on October 2nd at Trinity Lutheran Church. So a lot of chances for people to come out and support. Now, people may be thinking, well, this guy's been traveling around. What's he doing singing? You were a professional singer for a long time.
I was, yeah. I've been a professional singer for over a decade, and most recently spent a number of years singing at the Washington National Cathedral Choir. So if you watched the funeral for John McCain, all those people who were sitting behind Barack Obama and George Bush, that was me. Wow. And so I share a number of songs that I sang during my years at the cathedral, and I'm a countertenor, which is a male soprano. So I can pretty much guarantee you, if you come to the show, you will hear a voice type, a voice singing that you have never heard before in your life.
That's amazing. And these are songs that are inspired by your trips and by, as you mentioned, the people that you've met. Where is there someone who stands out? There's probably a lot more than one, but can you pick one person who you've met on the journey that has made an unusually large impact on you?
Well, I was down in Florida in Everglades National Park, and there's this thing called a sluice log where you have to walk through the alligator-infested muddy waters. Ooh. And our entire group was terrified, except our ranger, who introduced herself as Ranger Lori, and I'm a hillbilly from Alabama. And she said that she used to wear green to protect our country in the military, and now she was wearing green to protect our nature. And someone said, what happens if we come across an alligator? And she said, well, you ain't got to fear nothing, because I got this stick and I got the Lord, so no one's going to touch you.
There you go, Ranger Lori.
She appeared at other parks. She worked seasonally, so I saw her in Everglades, and then 6 months later at Dinosaur National Monument, and then 6 months later in Hawaii. So she's just been following me around the country. Yeah, with her stick, keeping me safe.
Well, that's good. Whether it, you know, whether it was planned or just by accident, thank goodness for Ranger
exactly.
Lori. Now,
yeah.
You know, I can't imagine, I've been to a few national parks. It's always beautiful. And again, I know I'm asking you to like try to pick your favorite kid, but one place that if somebody here was listening saying, all right, I want to get to a national park. I want the most bang for my nature buck. Where would you recommend?
Well, that's actually a very easy question, Brian, because since I don't work for any of the park organizations, I can tell you honestly what I think of them.
Yes.
And I've actually been ranking every single site on a scale of 1 to 10, all 417 parks. And I can tell you right now, my highest rated park is called Dinosaur National Monument. Mm-hmm. And it's on the border of Utah and Colorado. And it's about 3 hours drive from the closest interstate. So you practically are the only person at the park. It's got dinosaur bones. It's got amazing ridgeline hikes, and it has two rivers you can raft, some of the most amazing geology I've seen in our entire country, and because it's a national monument and not one of the big famous 60 parks, no one is there. So if you want a perfect week-long vacation, spend 2 days hiking, 4 days rafting, 1 day with the dinosaur bones, the kids are happy, you're happy, everyone's happy. Dinosaur National Monument.
Fantastic. Michael, listen, I hope people will come out and see the cabaret show as Michael makes his way through town as the journey continues. Again, Evanston on September 30th at 7 p.m. at Grace Lutheran Church. Valparaiso on October 2nd at 7 p.m. at Trinity Lutheran Church. For all the information and to donate to help Michael continue this journey, you can go to MichaelMeyer.com. That's Michael with a K, MichaelMeyer.com. I'm glad we got to touch base again. Please, as the journey winds up, will you join us again?
Totally. I will absolutely do it.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations. Keep up the good work, and we will talk to you soon, Micah.
Thank you so much. I hope to meet some of your listeners in person.
Us too. Take care. That's Micah Meyer of MichaelMeyer.com. Again, you can see the original cabaret show at Grace Lutheran Church in Evanston on September 30th at 7 p.m. MichaelMeyer.com for all the information. Let's do this. If you have a child, would you ever, ever sign a paper giving your child's school permission to spank them? You would think this should be all old. We shouldn't be talking about this anymore in 2018, but we are. And it's not, listen, Cody, I know you're thinking, where did you pick this topic up? 1900? No. This was actually in the Tribune today. That 2018. There's a school in Georgia, and it's a charter school, that has decided, you know, we take our discipline very seriously here at this charter school. And so we want you, parents, to sign a paper giving us permission to spank your children. Not with a hand, but no, we're going to, if your child gets in trouble, we're going to allow them to come in, we're going to bring them into the office, we're going to close the door. It's just going to be your child and the administrator, and they're going to have them either put their hands on their knees or bend over a piece of furniture, and they're going to hit them with a stick up to 3 times. That's how you ensure good orderly discipline in a school, by spanking your children. And they're saying, listen, you better sign it, because if you don't sign it and you don't give us permission to hit your kids, then we're just going to suspend your kids for 5 days. We're just going to, if you won't let us hit them, then we're just going to suspend them for up to 5 days. And as you can imagine, people are up in arms. Now, here's something 312-981-7200. I can't believe we're still having a, is it okay to spank your kids in school? And I don't want to say, well, I guess it's, you know, it's Georgia, so that makes sense. Because I've had wonderful times in Georgia. Northern Georgia, Southern Georgia, all over Georgia. The Big Chicken in Marietta, Georgia. I've had fun in Atlanta and Macon.
Though that is where the devil went down to.
Sure, because he was looking for a soul to steal. Cody, mm-hmm. He was in a bind. He was way behind.
Yeah.
He was willing to make a deal. You know what he did? He came across this young man.
Did he?
He was sawing on a fiddle, playing it hot. The devil jumps up on a hickory stump. He said, boy, let me tell you what.
What did he tell him then?
He said, I bet you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. You don't think I know all the words to this song, do you? I will do the entire song, including the fiddle solo. Don't watch me.
in regular conversation, though.
Of course.
That's what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah.
I'll do it. Anyway.
Relevant.
Sure. Who doesn't love a good Charlie Daniels riff on a Sunday afternoon as you're getting your kids' lunches ready for school tomorrow, or you're just putting your head down on a pillow going, oh, I can't believe I have to go back to work. 19 states still permit physical punishment in schools, according to a 2017 American Psychoanalytic Association. The APA points out 49 countries have banned physical punishment altogether. More than 100 countries have banned it in school. How is this still a thing? How is this barbaric approach to discipline in school still a thing? Now, I'm not talking about what you do in your own home. I still, you know, I am not convinced that we should be able to tell kids not to hit other people and then hit them when they're wrong. It sends a mixed message, and it also, studies will tell you and prove, that kids then begin to identify with the person who is hitting them and then become hitters themselves. So I'm not talking about how you choose to discipline your child in your home. I'm talking about you as a parent giving that power over to someone else and saying, yes, I'm going to trust, you know, Mr. Jones down at the school to spank my kid. It makes absolutely zero sense to me. And if you're taking your kid to this charter school and you get this note, how do you not withdraw them immediately? And go, yeah, listen, I'm all for discipline in schools. As a guy who's in schools all the time, I firmly believe there has to be discipline. But there is no chance that spanking is going to lead to any good long-term result. Sure, you might get that kid, you know, that kid might change his behavior in the next week. But now you've embarrassed him. You've hurt him or her physically. It makes absolutely no sense. 312-981-7200. Mark's in Joliet. He wants to jump in. Hi, Mark.
How are you doing today?
Good.
Good. I just want to comment, when I was in seventh grade, a friend of mine and I, my best friend and I were messing around in, science class, and we happened to bump into a table and knock a jar over and break it, and Miss Hunter didn't take that very well. And Miss Hunter had a paddle that was about 3 foot long with a baseball grip type handle on it and holes in this, paddle. And we each got 3 swats.
What?
And I tell you what, that was the last time we ever messed around in school. So it taught me a lesson, and I'm 61 years old.
Wouldn't you have learned that lesson? Wouldn't you have learned that lesson another way? Did your parents find out? Did you go home and say, "Hey, Miss Johnson spanked me"?
Yes, because if I hadn't told them, I would have gotten one at home. But I was never beaten as a kid, but I was disciplined, and I think there is a difference between disciplining and beating.
As I said, what you do as a parent to your child is a whole different thing. If I choose to spank my kid, I know how hard I'm going to do it. I know I'm going to whatever. You know, you're making those decisions. I would never allow a stranger with a paddle to hit my kid. If you have a problem with my kid at school, there's other ways to discipline and then send them home for whatever discipline I decide to meter out.
Yeah, I agree. I just know...
It worked for you, though, huh?
I have a lot of respect for our teachers, and I always have and things, but and I think that's what's missing a lot today.
Oh, yeah.
And there's no fear, there's no respect. And I'm not saying you should fear your teacher or you should fear anybody, but you should respect them, and that's missing a lot nowadays, unfortunately.
Yep. Mark, thanks for the call. It is missing. I don't think it's found at the end of a paddle, though, or I don't think it's found at the end of a stick on the backside of a kid who now you've pulled into a room. There are behavior problems in schools. There's no doubt about it. I see them firsthand. But there's different ways to handle it. And, again, ceding the control of your child's body to somebody else for discipline seems barbaric. It's horrible. From the 815, sounds like blackmail. We hit your kid or suspend them, trying to scare the parents. If what a kid does is a suspendable offense, they should be suspended. Also, what if this teacher likes to spank somebody more than others? Yeah, it's, and who's to say, you know, one day it's three light swats and one day it's hard. Again, when are we living? This is 2018. We still have to talk about, kids. From the 810, you can't even hit military recruits in boot camp anymore. That is true. From the 217, I'm a dad. Spanking at school isn't discipline. It's torture. No child should be hit or struck for any reason by anybody. The folks in that Georgia school should immediately call the police. That is from Tim in Urbana. From the 773, some kids need a spanking. Lack of good parenting at home causes bad kids who turn into bad adults. Go Georgia. From Tina, no. It's not the school's place to spank your children. It's really, and my view has changed on this over the years, because I grew up getting spanked, you know, and I've, even in high school, the Jesuits, every once in a while would throw a punch at somebody. So, you know, I come from a different background in a different time, and spanking was much more accepted. I don't think my parents would have, now while we might have gotten spanked at home occasionally, I don't think my parents would have looked too keenly on somebody at school spanking me, or my brothers. You know, they're just, they're, doesn't seem like good sound of thinking. Alright. So there we go. I'm not going to Georgia. Thankfully I don't have to worry about it. Cody, you know where Georgia is? I know you had trouble with Pennsylvania on a map.
Georgia is south of us.
It is south of the Mason-Dixon line. Do you know where that is?
It's between Mason and Dixon.
It is. Not Mason, Illinois, or Dixon, Illinois. It's just south. So like near the Bible Belt. Do you know where that is?
Yeah, it's between Genesis and Leviticus.
I love to watch you just go, I don't know any of the words that are coming out of your head.
Mason and Dixon is the name of a novel by Thomas Pynchon.
Wow.
Yeah.
Look at you, Mr. Literate.
Shout out to the book readers out there.
Yeah, look at Cody. I can read Goff.
I haven't read it.
Of course. But you knew the title.
It's one of my wife's favorite books.
It was a good pull. Either way, you're able to, you know, you're able to throw that right out.
Yeah.
Maybe your wife could read it to you.
Could that be our new segment?
Yeah, your wife comes in and reads a book.
Dr. Mrs. Goff reads...
Dr. Mrs. Cody Goff reads a chapter of Mason Dixon, or a sentence. Just a random passage from some sort of book.
Is it a novel?
Oh,
it's a novel.
It's a novel.
It's an epic novel. I would imagine we'd have time for a couple sentences a week.
Yeah, you throw the word epic in front of novel for me, you know what it means to me? Doorstop. Mm. I don't have time for that.
Mm.
I don't have time for 800-page books. I'm more of an epic pamphlet guy. You go to three pages in a pamphlet. You know, pamphlet usually just a nice bifold. You throw an extra page stapled in the middle, that's an epic pamphlet.
That is epic.
And I'll, you know, I've got time for that during a sit-down.
A staple in a pamphlet? Who's ever heard of such a thing?
I'm old school. I still mimeograph things.
Well, I know. I don't even know what that means.
Of course you don't. I have this conversation with my wife occasionally, because I do talk to my wife occasionally. It's, you know, one of the perils of being married, you got to talk to him. I say it jokingly. Because my wife often will work through lunch. And now Molly started a new job, and she doesn't go to lunch. She eats lunch at her desk. And I thought that was unusual, and yet it is not, according to a new study. We have data that says half of all Americans don't take a full lunch break. Now, I'll ask you about your regular job, Cody, because I picture you not only taking your regular lunch break, but your coworkers' lunch break as well. So if half the people at your office aren't taking them, you're picking up the slack.
What do you mean by lunch break? Does it break it down by, like, you don't eat anything, or you just don't?
No, it's that you don't leave your desk to eat lunch.
Okay, yeah.
Sometimes people won't even eat, but most of them will not leave their desk to eat lunch. It's not like, hey, you got a half hour or an hour, go out, you have lunch, you sit in the park, whatever, and you come back.
Right.
Doesn't that, boy, I made that sound so lovely, didn't I?
You did. You know, my last job, everyone used to eat at their desk, and they would call it El Desco, because that makes it sound cool.
Really? Does it make it sound cool?
And at my day job at Curiosity.com, a lot of my coworkers would eat at their desks until we wrote about a recent scientific study about how much bacteria is at the average person's desk. And now no one at our office is eating at their desk anymore. Like, it changed all of our habits because your desk... Sorry, listener, your desk is probably extremely disgusting.
Of course. Well, I'm looking at this. I'll call this my desk.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's filthy.
Oh, my God. No, in the producer booth? I mean, I should be wearing a hazmat suit right now.
Yeah, every surface at this radio station is funky.
And we've been here a month or 2 months. Yeah. Like, it's. But on average, your desk is a nightmare, and it's cleaned way less often and thoroughly than the kitchen. So if you are eating at your desk, you should... not do that.
You shouldn't do that.
Well, that's why you need these alcoholic wipes that I use.
Here. Look what we... I knew it. Hi, Roger.
Well, hi, guys.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
We didn't know you were ready yet to jump in, but we're glad you're here.
I appreciate it.
Now people start to... Well, you beat me to Roger. I'm not. They said people blame their workload. They say, I can't possibly take a break because I have such an intense workload and I have pressure to perform, so I'm not going to walk away. How many alcohol wipes do you use on that? Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Do you do it while Pam's still in there? To make her feel like she's really dirty?
Well, I do it right after everybody, every shift that I do on the weekends. There's the people who were right before me are still here, and they see me doing it.
Wow.
But
you don't find that offensive?
No, I say it's not personal. I would do it even if no one had been on here in the last 5 days. Doesn't matter.
Hmm.
In fact, the cleaning guy was just in here, and he started to wipe the desk after I had just wiped it down. I said, no, I got it. It's good.
Wow. You didn't trust him?
Huh? I didn't know he was coming in to clean. So, and you know what? Before I got sick 4 years ago, I would never have done it. For some reason, I don't know why, I just would never have done that. Not even thought about it.
I don't put that much thought into germs, to be honest with you. And I'm surrounded by little children who are spewing mucus all day. And, you know, there's all sorts of... I can't... You think that the surfaces here are disgusting, Cody? Mm-hmm. Go into an elementary school.
No.
Go on a table. Now, there I'll use, like, after they eat their breakfast on their tables and stuff, I'll take a wipe and do it. Pitch black. These wipes are when I'm done with the table.
It is.
Well, it's because they've been using their pencil on the desks.
Their pencil and goo and it just horrifying, horrifying. So you should take a break. But they say, listen, people are we're so proud of ourselves. We want to be known as the person who doesn't take a break. We're always at our desk. We're working hard. Experts say not stopping to eat, it's good for some people. It drives their energy into their work. It keeps them focused.
What?
However, on the negative side, it can lead to burnout. So they say if you're not going to take a 30-minute lunch break, take a couple short breaks during the day, you know. Or keep, do you have a snack drawer? I know Roger has probably snack, you know, closets over there.
I did have lots of snacks when I was teaching, especially towards the last couple of years.
Really?
Yeah, I had lots. Well, I learned too late in my career as a teacher that kids love candy and stuff. And
You didn't know kids liked candy till you were
no,
late
I was
in your
a strict,
career?
I was right? a strict taskmaster when I started. I thought that but I would that teach it mean, as a college level.
Right, but that doesn't mean you don't know children like candy.
I could care less if they like candy and that it would be a good motivator.
Oh, you used it
time.
To you gave candy to the children?
Well, yeah. Well, I would like fire it like a fastball at them, but
have you been drinking?
No.
Hmm. Sounds like you're...
No, I'm fine.
You're a little tipsy.
But it wasn't... It's from taking the lunch break, the last 4 years that I was teaching, they started requiring us to take meetings. Did you just get a candy?
I did. Pam came in, and she must be motivating us to do better. She brought us in some little Heath bars, and they're cold. I love a good Heath bar.
Ooh.
Yeah. Except now... When you're doing the news, I'll eat them, and then I'll spend the next half hour trying to dig the toffee out of my molars.
Now, wait a minute. Is that the fun size, or is that the larger size for Halloween?
There's no fun in this size.
It's the fun size. Yeah, I'm looking at it.
Stop. It's not fun. They call it the fun size. There's no fun in this size. A fun size Heath bar would be as big as Cody. It would be 6'4" long and weigh about 180 pounds.
And really good looking.
Well, it goes without saying, a Heath bar is always good looking.
Yeah.
A Heath bar is a fine looking piece of confectionery. That's right. All right, we got to do this. I'm going to tell you. Coming up, though, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. You know, we always hear, as we focus on tropical depression now, Florence, and natural disasters and things like that, that's when a lot of people think about, I need to donate blood. I need to make sure that that kind of thing gets done. So there's a good supply when disaster strikes, but the need for blood is ongoing. LifeSource is one of the big companies that handles all that. They have a huge event coming up Wednesday, the 19th at UIC. Get fired up to save lives. Kathleen Meyer is with us. She is with LifeSource, and no relation to Micah Meyer, who we spoke with before. In order to be a guest on the program today, your last name had to be Meyer. Kathleen, we're glad you're here. Thanks for taking some time today to talk about this. You are hoping Wednesday to be one of the biggest single-day, single-site drives in history, correct?
Yes, we are, and we are excited that we have already exceeded our goal going into the day of the number of appointments we'll have. On Friday, we had close to 900 appointments. We're hoping for at least 500, so it's going to be a huge day.
That's terrific. Now, I mentioned it before I brought you on. People think about donating blood when somebody in their family is having an operation or when there's a catastrophic event. How big is the need for blood donation on just a regular Tuesday?
So on any regular day, we like to have at least 3 days worth, if not more, of each blood product on hand. So that's every different type, platelets, plasma, regular whole blood. That's kind of where we like to be. And we have seen this summer, and especially recently and around Labor Day, and now we've been worried about how the hurricane will affect things. I know our O negative supply has been teetering around a day or less. And so it fluctuates throughout the year, but we definitely see around the summertime, around major holidays, and then in the wintertime, and then anytime there's some kind of large natural disaster or any kind of tragedy, our supply tends to dip. But then we get a lot of people that come out and want to donate to help support people around the country.
Well, a lot of people donate all the time, and some people still, they're hesitant. What do you think the biggest misconceptions are for people who still are a little nervous about going in to donate blood?
I think a lot of people do say they're afraid of the needle, and I always like to tell them, you have to think about the other person that needs it, the person on the other end. Your donation, an hour out of your day to save someone, it's impacting someone greatly on the other end. So try not to think about the needle if that's what you're afraid of. Try to think about the good that you're doing and the people that you're helping.
Who's eligible to donate?
So people can be 16 or 17 years old with parental consent, otherwise 18 and up. There's no cap on the age. You just have to be healthy and feeling good the day of your donation. There's different things that come into play, like travel. There's certain areas of the world where there's malaria risk, and there's different things that we ask for. So it might temporarily defer you from donating. Deferrals are usually not permanent.
Okay.
There's different medications that might come into play, but generally speaking, a lot of people are eligible. And if you're not sure, there's information on our website, lifesource.org, or you can always call us or talk to our staff at the time of donation to see if you're eligible.
So for a first-time person, if somebody's going to come out to UIC on Wednesday, September 19th, between 7:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m., and you can make your appointment by going to lifesource.org or by calling 877-573-3768, 877-573-3768. First-time donor that comes out, what can they expect? What's the process for somebody going through the first time? How do you screen? What happens?
Yeah, so at UIC, because we're expecting so many people, it'll be slightly different. When people walk in the pavilion where the drive is taking place, they'll be greeted by some of our staff that'll ask them some really simple questions and easy things that might quickly rule them out from donating, such as travel or medication.
Okay.
Usually at a donor center or a regular drive that's not of this size, you'll fill out a questionnaire that'll go through kind of your medical history, talk about different medications or health concerns. It takes maybe 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes or so to get through that. You'll talk to our staff. They'll check your blood pressure, your pulse, your iron, all of these things just to make sure it's healthy for you to donate and you're safe to donate, and then also that what you're donating, your blood, will make it through all of our testing and it'll be safe to transfuse to a patient later. After you get through all of that kind of pre-screening and registration, you'll actually go to the donor bed, and our staff will talk you through what they're doing. It's the actual donation itself is maybe 10 minutes. Some people are really fast, and it's only 5 minutes. It kind of depends person to person. I know my husband and I, we like to race each other.
What makes somebody go fast?
I think it's just the size of their vein, and then, you know, how good consistency of their blood. I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
But I know my husband and I like to race each other to see who can finish faster. so they'll sterilize your arm. They'll, you know, insert the needle, take the donation. They'll chat with you, hang out with you the whole time, make sure you're feeling okay. And then once you're done, we have like a refreshment area. So we want you to hang out for 10, 15 minutes, okay, have something to eat, have some juice and water, make sure you're feeling all right before you go about your day. And that's about it.
Very nice. And again, this is the goal for the 19th at UIC is to be the biggest single day, single location blood drive in Chicago history. You're hoping to collect over 700 units of blood. Is it a unit per person? Is that how it works, or how does it work?
Yeah, so most people will be donating whole blood, and so that's a unit per person. We will have our Alex machines, which collect double red cells, so it's a slightly different process, and those we count as two units. So most people, though, will be doing whole blood. We probably need to see close to 900 to 1,000 people to make our goal, because there will be people that just aren't able to donate because their iron's too low, or they get there and then they realize, oh, I traveled to this part of the world and that makes me ineligible today. So there's going to be kind of natural drop-off. But we're pretty confident that we're going to get to 700 just based on the excitement that we've seen so far and the number of appointments we have booked so far.
Well, it is a worthwhile cause. Get fired up to save lives. It's the big blood drive at the UIC Pavilion. It is on Wednesday, September 19th from 7:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the UIC Pavilion. If you go to lifesource.org, you can make your appointment, or you can call 877-573-3768 to make your appointment. You can also get all your questions answered at lifesource.org. So go there and go donate blood. You're going to save a life. Kathleen, it was great to talk to you. Now, who are you predicting? Do you want to put some money down? Are you and your husband for Wednesday? Who's going to finish faster?
Oh, it'll probably be him. I probably shouldn't bet.
All right. Well, Cody and I will put some action down on your husband then beating you for his unit. That sounded wrong. Kathleen, congratulations. Good luck with the drive on Wednesday, and I hope you go well past the 700 units.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Take care. That is Kathleen Meyer with LifeSource, lifesource.org. Wednesday, the big blood drive. Have you ever donated blood, Cody? He doesn't even donate attention to this program.
My wasn't in my mic wasn't on, was it? It's been a bit, but I think somebody at one point told me I couldn't because of diabetes, but then I think you can actually.
Right. I have to. Yeah. See, I feel like I'm shirking my duty as a citizen.
Yeah, everyone should do it. It used to be bad. Like when I get a lot of blood drawn, I'm like one of those people that just passes out and can't handle it or whatever. It's always.
I mean, I've had to give blood for blood tests and stuff. It's not the needle. I don't know what. I don't know. I guess I just don't think about it. I have to do it. Yeah. I have to go.
Everyone should do it. Everyone should make this one a huge success.
Yes, let's go.
It's Wednesday, awesome
the 19th at UIC Pavilion. Lifesource.org is where you can get all the information. All right. We've got to do this. Then we've got more. Because we're only here till 7, you know.
Let's go with that music. Crazy. I don't know what you're up to.
I figured I'd wake myself up. You know what I think it was? The reason I was a second late there a minute ago talking to you is I don't have any lights on in here.
Okay.
Have you noticed it's
why
dark?
Why is that? It is dark in there.
It's the light switch is far from me, and I just haven't. I haven't really felt like turning it on, but I think it's maybe making me sleepy.
Could be. I keep the lights dim. But here's the other thing with this place, and I noticed this at a couple people's homes, too. We had their new studios the new studios built, and they're very lovely. But they have some weird high-tech light switches that make controlling the lighting in here very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say that because it makes me sound like a complete buffoon. that I can't work the light switch, Daddy. It just makes me sound dumb. And yet, it's the truth. There's something in here with a wheel and a sensor and colors, but all the colors seem to be the same. And I can't, and then it's really bright, like I'm on the surface of the sun, which is not conducive to me having clear thoughts. Not that anything is conducive to me having clear thoughts, but it's one of those things I don't quite understand.
They're very fancy. I think that our infrastructure allows for television segments, and we can do all sorts of different colors and LEDs. But unfortunately, I didn't do very well in my lighting class, my TV lighting class in college.
That's a shame. I didn't take a TV lighting class in college.
Oh, dude, it was hard.
I don't know.
It was like the hardest unit we did.
I just showed up at the TV station and did what they told me.
TV lighting is so hard.
Well, that's why there's professional lighting people.
Yeah.
That's why. When I did the episode of the NBC episodic that's coming up pretty soon, I could say it now. It's Chicago Med.
Hmm.
The lighting people. It's crazy. What are you nodding your head like that for?
You said that.
Did I?
You said Chicago Med like a month ago.
Well, that's when I taped it a month ago. It hasn't aired yet. It's going to air sometime soon. I'll let you know. I'll let you know when.
Well, you let me know.
Or I won't. And I'll just go, hey, did you see the episode? You're going, no. You missed out. It was fun. But the point is, the lighting people there, that's their job. It's not supposed to be easy. If it was easy, every Yahoo could do it. It's a skill like anything else. It's a talent.
I'm just letting the listener of our...
Well, this is radio. Theoretically, we should be able to do this in the dark.
No, but I'm informing people that lighting is harder than it looks.
Well, yes, but my point is, walking into a room and turning on the light shouldn't be that difficult.
Shouldn't, but we have a problem with that anyway.
Does it make the show, better because I have ambient lighting or mood lighting? I don't know. I just want to come in, get the old place. I walked in and I flipped the switch. You know what happened? The lights came on. Mm. It was phenomenal. I didn't have to worry about a thing. I have enough to worry about. Well, whether there's illumination in my workplace should not be, I'm sure when you go to work tomorrow, you're going to walk into your place of business and the lights will just be there. You'll know where to walk over and you'll turn them on and everything will be lovely. But I'm sure we've all been in workplaces where they do something and you're just like, I don't quite understand that. And then it makes your job, not more difficult. It's just one more thing, In a world where we all have enough things to throw on one more thing.
The thing that gets me...
Am I whining? Sure, a little bit.
The thing that gets me here is that we've got this little wall that's a partition between two of our hallways. And on one side of the wall is like a 4-foot by 4-foot painting of... I don't even know what's on it. I don't look at it. Like some... I don't know, some sports thing. It's like 4 feet by 4 feet.
That's a safe bet.
Now, on one side of this wall, there's that painting, and it takes up the whole wall. Right. On the other side of the wall, there's nothing. It's white, it's blank, there's nothing on that wall, not even a scanner for your badge, because you can just go through that side of the door. Now, there's a scanner on one side of the door that you have to scan to walk through it to open it.
This is not going
to
end well for
you. There's not a scanner on the other side.
Correct.
Now, rather than move the painting to the side with no scanner, they put the painting up on the side with the scanner, covered the scanner with it, and printed out one of those things with the...
Like a label maker?
Like a label maker. So, what are they called, though?
A label.
All right. Someone printed a label maker thing that said, scan badge here, and they labeled it on the painting.
Yes.
So that's the thing that happened. So, sometimes... Weird things happen.
Weird things do happen. I didn't notice that was there. I noticed the painting was there.
It's a sticker on a painting. It's like, what? How did that occur? I don't know.
But the painting is not like on loan from the Louvre or anything.
No, we own it.
It's a WGN painting, so they could put a label
on art.
It. Right.
Well, theoretically, you could put a sticker on the Mona Lisa. You wouldn't.
No.
But you could.
I don't think the two are comparable, though, necessarily.
Well, they're both
paintings.
Right. Well, that was it.
It's
not a fancy painting. You can put a sticker on it. No, people don't just walk around going, man, this painting is basic. I'm not going into a hotel room, at the Motel 6, gazing on the landscape above the bed, praying for a slow death, and then putting a sticker on it.
Saying,
you say scan.
Scan. here.
Scan your life expectancy here. I'm not doing any of that. Or, you know, leave your blood test, you know, results on. No, I'm not putting stickers on art just because art is not fancy or very expensive, right. Doesn't mean you can should put stickers on it.
But I think everyone fell into that trap. Because the trap of not seeing the sticker there and going, oh, gosh, I can't get through this door, you know, and then having to go all the way around.
You know what that means to me?
What?
We got to get some smarter folks working.
No. Bigger stickers.
Oh, man, bigger stickers.
Bigger stickers with a big red arrow.
Or maybe more expensive art that does it. You know what we do? You cut a picture. Since Rogers offered defacing art that is not classics, you just cut a hole right in there.
Yeah.
And let the scanner show right through. Would
you
that
should.
Make you feel better? Put a piece of saran wrap over it so it's see-through.
Isn't it a Blackhawks?
No. It's all the buzzwords about the station.
Oh, that one. Okay. All right.
Big microphone and some buzzwords.
All right. Well, maybe, cut a
hole
in there
and
say.
One of the buzzwords should have been? Scan.
Scan.
Scan here. That's what one of the buzzwords should have been. Scan here. But no, they weren't. We weren't thinking ahead. We didn't plan ahead when we contracted for this painting.
Well they weren't sure where it was going to hang in the facility, you know? And so, you know.
Poor planning is never an excuse, Roger. This could be the final segment we ever do.
Yeah.
This could be it. Oh, and you had the pleasure of hearing it.
It was my fault. For once, it was my fault.
This one, you went down a rocky path, which was my boxing name back in the day.
Rocky Path?
Rocky Path. Sure. Rocky Path. That was my...
Undefeated still.
Sure, of course. Nobody could traverse me. All right, listen. Enough of this frivolity. We need to... I don't know who ever said that radio was supposed to be fun. We're not... I don't understand this.
Mm.
Somebody upset with me that I have not updated my IMDb page. it's news to me that I have an IMDb page. I'll put a picture on there, and, somebody's like, what are you gonna update your IMDb page? You have no bio and no photo. And no career. Let's be honest. really? I mean, it's like dressing up a pig. I could do it, but you know how I am about animals wearing clothes. All right, are we going straight to the news or do we have a break? We have a break? All right, let's do this, and then Roger will have the news, allegedly. We'll see, unless he's, out defacing cheap art. Tomorrow night at O'Hare Airport from 7 to 10, there is a scheduled demonstration by the Chicago Rideshare Advocates, a group made up for and of rideshare drivers for Uber, Lyft. Two of the founders of that organization, Matea Nanfria and Barb Lloyd, join me now on WGN. Ladies, good evening. Thank you for taking some time.
Hi there. How are you?
So, Matea, we'll start with you. How long have you been driving? What service do you drive for, and how long have you been driving?
I have been a rideshare driver in Chicago for just over 4 years now. I have predominantly worked mostly with Lyft, but I also have some experience with Uber, about 11,000 rides with Lyft and a little over 3,000 rides with Uber at this point.
And how about you, Barb?
I just hit my fifth anniversary this summer. So 5 years and change, and only Lyft. In the beginning, I drove for Uber for a few months, but I made the decision to drive exclusively for Lyft early on.
And what made you make that decision?
Originally, it was, as Mateo will know, we were we felt the company was behind the drivers and the passengers. It was much friendlier company. Now, we have issues with both companies, so we're trying to change the system, yeah.
Well, full disclosure, I drove for both companies for a short time, so I kind of feel you. How did the Chicago Rideshare Advocates come to be? How did the group form?
Well, a bunch of us have been kind of keeping our eye on these companies for a minute. They started pulling some fast ones on drivers and passengers. I'd say in the last couple of years, drivers have become more and more discontent after pay cut, after pay cut, after pay cut. And we kind of started seeing some, underhanded behaviors with not being transparent with payments anymore, either on the customer side or the driver side. So a bunch of us have kind of been sitting on the sidelines, just kind of feeling out the situation, thinking that maybe at some point we might have to start really voicing our concerns publicly. But really, this past spring, Lyft in particular tried to bring a new bonus system to Chicago, a new structure that really undermined drivers and customers. And to their credit, after the driver workforce pushed back very vehemently against this new structure, Lyft pulled it from the Chicago market. So we all kind of breathed a sigh of relief for a moment. But we knew that Uber was testing something similar in other markets and that Uber was also being underhanded with pricing with customers and then not passing full fares onto drivers anymore as well. So we were anticipating that they would roll out their program nationwide as well. But it turns out that since Lyft came to Chicago first with their new bonus system that we vehemently rejected and they pulled it, it's almost as if Uber decided that Chicago was going to be the first major market that they tried to attack with the similar bonus structure over there. So they came to Chicago, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago now with this new structure. And again, drivers are very upset. Uber has a bigger driver working for that platform than Lyft does. But Lyft has always had that stronger community. So Lyft, to their credit, listened to the drivers. They removed, at least in the Chicago market, they removed that program for the time being. But once we saw that Uber brought it here, we knew that we were going to have to take the opportunity now to unify our voices and to push back very hard, because the companies are not relenting. They consistently.
How unified is the driver pool? Because as of December, there were 68,000 registered rideshare drivers in Chicago. You had a rally at City Hall last week. How unified are the drivers? Because it seems like it would be very hard to get a unified front in a business that's all freelancers. You know, you kind of have a common goal because everybody wants to make as much as they can, but in the end, it's every man or woman for themselves. So how are you having trouble uniting? How many drivers are backing you? What's the feeling on that?
Right now, we're doing it in two different ways. We've been talking, the TMP lots, the airport lots, are a good place to hook up with a lot of drivers in a very small space. So we've been talking to drivers there. I've had one driver out of 500 that I've talked to that isn't behind this, and they're new. so they don't, sorry, found what I thought was a quiet place to park. And so they don't really recognize the difference. And when we talk about bonus pricing, what I'm not sure if the riders are really aware of, and one of the reasons we're doing this is to make not only the other drivers aware, but the riders aware that when they're paying a surge price of 200 or 300%, that money is no longer going to the driver. The driver is getting a flat bump. So an example fare from Ravinia to downtown after an event, the passenger paid $204. The driver was paid
$55. That doesn't seem right.
Yeah. So this is happening on every surge ride under Uber right now. And in all honesty, even though Lyft did listen to us in the beginning, our concern is that if we can't shut this down with Uber, then Lyft will bring it back as well. And the problem with this is the whole point of surge pricing is after an event or when the weather's really bad, it brings more drivers to an area. If the drivers aren't making that money, then the companies are just charging the passengers more for no reason. It's not going to bring any more drivers into the area, because why would they drive through a foot and a half of snow when it's 50 below outside, when they're not making any more than on a sunny spring
morning, afternoon.
One of the other things that Chicago Rideshare Advocates is pushing for, you want the city to pass legislation, which they just they recently did in New York, to limit the amount of cars that can be out there, and also to bring up an average wage for drivers. So they say right now, according to the companies, the average wage for a driver is about $11, a little over $11 an hour after expenses. The argument against, and the companies with Lyft and Uber are saying, listen, to put an arbitrary cap on the amount of cars that are on the road is going to end up hurting communities that really need these rideshare services, where, you know, it'd be like the old argument that cabs won't go to certain neighborhoods. Well, if you cap the amount of drivers that can be out there, you may get the same kind of deal where neighborhoods are not served as properly as they are now.
In all honesty, that's a bogus argument, because as a driver for 5 years, I'm actually coming out less. I used to religiously work the same hours every week. And I, you know, some weeks I'd make a little less, but generally I knew what I could make because it averaged out per ride. And I didn't care where it took me. And I went wherever my rides did, whether it was to Naperville or to Bronzeville or to, you know, to the South Shore, wherever it took me, my rides took me. Now, because of our decrease in per mile charge and the increase in our expenses out here on the road, I am very judicious now, and I only tend to come out and work events, because otherwise it's not profitable.
Mm-hmm. So you think it would be more profitable? Is then the argument that if there were less drivers, then it would be more profitable?
I would love to speak on this.
Sure.
Driver cap is so fundamentally important for the following reason. Both companies, a friend of mine actually just told me a little while ago that there are recruiters for both companies that know, they're admitting to people, to drivers. They are actively recruiting. Both companies are recruiting so heavily right now because they understand that this driver cap is probably going to start sweeping in every market across the nation. Driver caps are important. The number of drivers on the road has tripled since 2015, okay? It is affecting not only our roadways, but also, have you noticed how bad the traffic is on the Kennedy on a regular basis?
Always.
If you look around, you will literally see TNP stickers on 70% of the cars on the road. The traffic downtown, the closer you get to the lake, traffic is abhorrent. The amount of pollution that these cars are spitting there is abhorrent, okay? When the companies can flood the market with drivers, it actually devalues their driver base, okay? Mm-hmm. By oversaturating the market, they are able to keep artificially low fares. These are artificially low fares that we are being paid, okay? It was a race to the bottom with fares. They cut fares a number of times in order to drum up more business, they said. But the more drivers they have on the road, the less they have to actually treat us like human beings and incentivize so that we can be profitable out here. If they have a huge group of new drivers come in that never experience the higher rates, and they don't understand how surge and prime time are supposed to act as a catalyst to draw in drivers when there is an imbalance between supply and demand. That is what they have been telling the city for years, that supply and demand, that surge and prime time are meant as a mechanism to help control supply and demand, like with hotels and airlines, that if there's too much demand, not enough supply, price goes up, it draws extra cars in, that first wave of cars leaves, in the meantime more cars are coming, and then the prices generally flatten out again, right, after events or snowstorms or holidays.
Well, ladies, I gotta get rolling, but what do you hope to accomplish tomorrow with the rally at O'Hare? What's the goal for the rally tomorrow?
Well, the big issue is to make as many drivers and passengers aware of our plight, because in all honesty, Chicago is the lowest per mile city in the United States. We get paid less per mile than any other city, and what we're asking for is a decent per mile and a cap on drivers.
All right.
So it's safe out there.
And no. This is the rally tomorrow is not meant to disrupt service at the airport. You're just you're using that as an area because you have a high concentration of drivers that you can get your message out to, correct?
Exactly. They may not be online. It's going to be a peaceful rally to drum up support, educate drivers. So we will not be blocking entrances or exits. We will be following all laws. And we're asking that people that have legal access to that lot be the only ones that show up.
All right. Chicago Rideshare Advocates, you can follow them on Facebook, get all the information. Mattia Nanfria and Barb Lloyd, thanks very much for joining me, ladies.
Thank you, sir.
Good luck.
Appreciate you having us.
All right, my pleasure. All right, let's do this, and then we must start wrapping things up. We'll probably talk to Karen and find out what she's got on the show at some point. I know we'll do that at some point before 7. Wow, you are, you've got a very heavy-handed musical taste today.
Heavy-handed?
It's very, it's a heavy music. It's a lot of, you know, it's angry music. It's, I want to punch you in the throat music.
Yeah.
How about something melodious and gentle?
We used to throat punch all the time on this show, Brian.
We did. That was back in the day.
I'm trying to bring back the old throat punchy, hard hitting throat punchy
all right,
segments.
Let's get it going. Let's do it. We've got about 4 minutes left.
All right.
I was thinking about this rally tomorrow and the drivers. I'll be honest. I understand the argument from the companies, the rideshare companies' perspectives, saying, listen, if you put arbitrary caps on, you're gonna not serve some markets. I can see why they're saying that. But I also see all these cars on the road, and I'm getting sick of it. I'm getting sick of people throwing a Power U in front of me just because they're, you know, their Uber or Lyft app went off and they're gonna go catch a ride, so they think they can just, you know, go wherever their car wants to go. There's got to be a middle ground. You know, you have to have areas that can be, all the neighborhoods need to be served. Everybody in Chicagoland should have access to a rideshare. But does that mean that we just allow unlimited amounts of drivers? You know, you could argue, well, listen, the cars are there. People have these cars. The companies aren't putting more cars on. They're maybe getting more people out driving at certain times than there used to be, but traffic has always been awful. So it's not, you know, it's not the easiest way to make a side hustle, which is how it's, you know, how it's presented. Oh, man, yeah, just hop in your car, whatever you want. Go pick up a few $100. Really? You know, and then you take it much more than I rarely do rideshare. When I'm with Molly, I'll do it, but I don't. Do you do it? Do you do it? Have you noticed a difference? You know, they're talking about all these new drivers and different fares for the passengers. Have you noticed a big change?
Well, the flow of traffic is massively different.
It's horrifying.
I mean, just on Michigan, I actually took a ride here to get downtown this morning.
Oh.
And just on Michigan Avenue, we're in the right lane. We had to go around at least 4 or 5 other cars that were stopped in front of random places picking people up.
Yeah.
And side streets in Chicago, I mean,
forget it.
Even, you know, anywhere you are in Lincoln Park, wherever you're driving in this city, chances are you're going to end up on a street where someone's got their hazards on, their flashers, and they're just sitting there picking somebody up.
Because the people who have summoned them, you know, believe the rideshare driver to be their own servant, and servants can wait for the master to come out. And so the you know, that's part of it, too. It's, if you order a rideshare, be standing out on the curb when that car pulls up in front of you.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
That is infuriating, is the conduct of many passengers who don't think that it's their responsibility to be downstairs or be outside when a driver pulls up.
Why do that?
It's very, very
frustrating. I'm much more important than the person who's going to be driving. You know that. All right, let's do this, and then we'll talk to Karen, because I'm sure, I have a feeling there might be a few legal things popping up around the, you know, around the old newsroom that that Karen will discuss. So we'll talk to Karen Conti right after this, WGN. All right, final few minutes. I welcome Karen Conti in. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Brian, I miss being on the air with you. These few minutes just, that just doesn't do it for me.
Listen, I don't know what management makes decisions. We just live it. I do, because especially now, I started to talk about this earlier, and I went, oh, I know Karen's going to talk about the Jason Van Dyke trial, and they finally seated the jury, and I know we would have talked about that forever. So tomorrow, everything's supposed to start, and I know you're going to talk about this.
Yeah.
What's the matter, Cody? I don't know. He whispers in my ear and expects me to hear him. Anyway, so this is the interesting thing, and I would just ask you this because I know you're going to talk about it. Is that a usual thing for the defense to go through the whole jury process and then still there was that question, is it going to be a jury trial or is it going to be a bench trial?
It's very unusual that that happens. But I was surprised he went with the jury. Although he did get a pretty good jury from the purposes of just the racial makeup, in my view. But this judge, to me, it might have been a better idea. I mean, I really was betting on him going with the judge, just because judges can put aside their passion a little bit more than jurors can, and all this pressure is going to be on these jurors to do whatever the right thing is that they think. And with all the people protesting, the judge is a tough guy. He's probably not running for re-election. He could put that aside. He could follow the law, and I think he would have a better chance. But, you know, the lawyer knows more than I do in this case.
Who ultimately makes that decision? Is it Jason Van Dyke? Is it his attorney? It's got to be a combination,
You're
right?
You're absolutely right, because you always ask the client. You tell the client, this is what I recommend for the following reasons, but it's up to you.
Okay.
Look at these jurors. Do you think they can be fair? Here's the pros and cons. Here's my recommendations. And generally, the lawyer will, his recommendations are going to be followed.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's
a big decision.
I couldn't imagine having to make it.
It's a big decision. Absolutely.
Because if it doesn't go in your favor, you're always going to second guess, should I have done the opposite?
And the only really good thing about going with the jury in this situation is that on appeal there still might be that argument that there was undue pretrial publicity and that it was impossible to get a fair jury.
And if a jury is deadlocked, that throws things into it. You can't get that if you go to a bench trial.
That's
the judge is going to make a decision one way or another, and that's pretty much it. What else are you going to talk about tonight?
Talk about the Manafort plea bargain. That was a really interesting thing. We're having Joe the Shark Lopez. Remember, he represented Drew Peterson.
Oh, yeah.
And he represented the Family Secrets trial. So one of the defendants there.
Is it good for an attorney to have a nickname like the Shark?
You know, when you are Joe Lopez, it is okay,
because
he's just kind of banks on him, you know, the flamboyant kind of thing. I couldn't get away with it. I would be like Karen the Minnow Conti.
That doesn't intimidate me.
No, I don't think so.
Not at all. So you talk about Manafort, you talk about Van Dyke, you got a lot to talk about.
And
it's only 2 hours, so we better let you get to it. Always good to see
you.
We'll talk to you next week. Hear the sounds that matter. The top 5 at 5 from the Rokan Show with Anna DeVellante's weekday afternoons on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, just say play WGN radio on TuneIn. It is 7 o'clock-ish, give or take, with the news. Here's Roger Bat.